My favorite thing about Bill Mitchell and When Dating Hurts podcast is the opportunity to share my voice and my story. I think that no matter where you are in listening about someone else's situation or sharing your own, that being within a community of listeners where it's safe to share a voice is invaluable. Thank you, Bill.
When Dating Hurts podcast continues to grow in popularity, the more who listen, the more who will know the realities of dating and domestic violence. In the meantime, the When Dating Hurts book, in paperback, ebook, and audiobook, is being purchased and read by concerned parents, teachers, victims and survivors, and of course, those who are currently dating. Education leads to empowerment. That way, if a potential abuser is targeting you or someone you care about, you will know how to detect it and how to break free and stay safe. Up next, another survivor story to illustrate how an innocent person can become manipulated and trapped in abusive relationships. Alexandra's story begins in Australia, where she was born, and where we meet up with Michael, an artist and a narcissistic abuser. The kind of a guy we lie awake at night hoping our daughters never meet up with or date. We leave Australia for Vienna, Austria, and then Poland, where the emotional abuse and violence gets about as horrible as we can imagine. There is a stop in Sweden, where it seems like a new relationship with a man named Magnus begins, but we'll leave all of this to Alexandra to tell. This story comes with trigger warnings due to the nature and descriptions involved. Here's part one of Alexandra's two-part story. Today on the When Dating Hurts podcast, we're speaking with Alexandra. She's going to tell us her story that will lead into a couple of different guys that she dated and had, I'd have to say, the full menu of things that can happen in dating, abuse, domestic violence relationships. With Alexandra, welcome to the When Dating Hurts podcast.
Thank you, Bill. I'm happy to be here, finally, after 11 months of avoiding.
Yes. I was saying to her earlier that she holds the record for the longest relationship before the recording, because we've passed some emails back and forth for 11 months, and we finally arrived, and I'm very happy to finally really meet you. I thought maybe it would be good for all of us to give us a sense of where you grew up and mm-hmm. who was home and what that felt like before we jump into all the dating twists and turns.
Yeah, sure. So I'm based in Switzerland. I've been here for 7 years, but I grew up in Australia in quite a small beach town, very beautiful national parks and beautiful beaches. And yeah, I had quite an idyllic childhood in some senses. I grew up in a lovely house and, you know, went to a private school. So I'd say I had quite a privileged upbringing, which is, you know, also in a way why I've been a little hesitant to share my story with everything going on in the world. Like, maybe it's a bit self-indulgent to do so, but I think it's important to share what knowledge I've gained. So yeah, I had a pretty, on the surface, idyllic childhood, but both of my parents were narcissists, and my mom was quite abusive, and my dad was quite absent, and he was a high-functioning alcoholic and involved in infidelities and things like that. So I think that's where my involvement with other narcissists in my adulthood kind of evolved from, because I think I grew up normalizing that kind of abuse, you know. Yeah.
I think about this all the time, that when someone grows up in a home where one or two of the parents are narcissistic or physically abusive or whatever that is, it perplexes me and others why later on you back into a relationship with someone later on who has a lot of the same characteristics. I mean, it would seem like the one thing you'd want to avoid, like, wow, I never want to meet up or marry some guy like dad or I don't want wouldn't want to meet up with somebody who has the characteristics of mom. And yet that does kind of happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's familiar. It's the typical thing, you know, if a kid grows up in an environment where that's what love is, or that's what is, you know, normalized for them, I think that's what you gravitate to. At least for me, you know, I didn't realize that it was, you know, trauma bonding and unhealthy, the dynamics that I had, until much later on. That was normal for me, you know, this kind of relationship growing up.
Do you think it's kind of like, I don't really like it, but I know it?
Yes. I think as I matured, I learned not to like it. But I think as, even as a teenager and in my early 20s, I enjoyed that drama and chaos, because that's what I had. That's what I knew. That's what intimacy was for me, especially, you know, my dynamic with my mother every day of my life was that way. So I think I sought that out. Otherwise, you know, it was boring for me, which is really sad.
So mom's narcissistic. Now, if you could give me a couple of scenes from you growing up and she's into her narcissistic act, what's going on? What mental videotapes can you run for us? What was going on?
Well, the thing is, I do have a lot of memory loss. So I did EMDR therapy, I would say around 2016, 17. So most of the snippets I have actually came up in EMDR therapy when I was working on, you know, my abusive relationships in adulthood. Suddenly I was back in my childhood, and all of these repressed memories were coming up, which was really unnerving, actually. So one memory I had is, I'm not sure if it's common in the States, but often if you were swearing as a kid, parents would say, you know, if you say that word again, I'll brush your teeth out with hand soap. And she actually did that. So I think she didn't realize it should just be a threat. She really did put hand soap on a toothbrush and force me over the sink and brush my teeth or mouth out, like scrub my gums until I was spitting blood out. So that's one memory that came back in EMDR therapy, which was quite disturbing. And she would get a skipping rope and tie it around my bedroom door and then around a stair banister across from my bedroom door, and really trap me in my room for, you know, 6 hours or something if I, you know, if I was misbehaving, because she didn't want to, I guess I don't really understand what was going on with her, but she had her own traumas and some kind of undiagnosed mental health problems, but that, just a lot of screaming too, you know.
The fact that you are not in Australia at this point and you've been away for, did you say 7 years? Is that right?
I'm 33 now and I moved out of home at 17 and I haven't lived with her since. I haven't lived with my family since. Yeah, but I've been all over.
But I mean, you leaving there, that wasn't just because you had something else you wanted to do. I mean, it sounds like you kind of needed to escape that world.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, when I left at 17, I was also struggling with chronic depression and anxiety, and it didn't have the hindsight and awareness of what was going on that I have now. I was still very much ensnared in that kind of dynamic, especially with my mother. Now it makes a lot of sense to me why I would like to live in Europe and be able to control the dynamic.
You definitely put some space between you, just half of the world.
Yeah.
That is kind of home life. It was you and your brother during that time?
Yeah, my little brother.
Did he get the same kind of treatment, similar treatment?
Not at all. No.
Really?
Not at all. No.
Why would that be?
I think where I responded with a lot of anger and, you know, a lot of outbursts, and, you know, I was kind of reacting to the abuse in a quite explosive way.
Right.
My brother was the opposite. He would really withdraw into himself. He was quiet. He stayed out of the way. So he was really seen as the model child, and I was the problem child. Yeah. As most, I think it's quite common. Yeah.
Do you think he just was, a lot of it besides his personality, but he was just a compliant kind of a guy? In other words, if they wanted something, he'd do it. He'd just avoid the hell that might rain down on him.
definitely so compliant and so submissive. And for better or worse, he's still like that. Very different to me.
How many years apart are you?
3 years. Yeah. He's still in Australia. He's an engineer and going through his own issues, probably because he's too compliant and too authority fearing and too passive in some ways. But he's a lovely person. Yeah.
Do you still have a good relationship with him?
Yeah. Yeah. We stay in touch. We're not super close, but we have an understanding and a mutual respect for each other, which is more than I can say for most of my family. So it's nice.
I would imagine you started dating when you were still in Australia.
Yeah. I mean, I started dating when I was probably 17 or so, like my final year of high school. It was always kind of a nightmare. I think I was pretty, the thing is, if kids are really academically gifted, it can sometimes not be so apparent to people that they're very emotionally underdeveloped. So I would say I was like a very emotionally underdeveloped person, just coming from what the background I did come from. So I would always seek out quite out of control, unhealthy boyfriends, even from the start, you know.
Do you think that that's, again, because you desired the drama that comes with that versus somebody who's very stable, let's say, but on the other hand, sometimes a little on the boring side?
Definitely, definitely. It was very much like I wanted chaos. I wanted drama, not in a conscious level, but definitely subconsciously. If I ended up with a nice guy, I would jeopardize that. I would go out and find some awful guy to cheat on him with. That was kind of how I was when I was in my late teens, early 20s. I was completely dysfunctional when it came to choosing men. I was very much into the unhinged, unstable, drug and alcohol abusing nightmare men.
Do you think that you looked at that when that was going on? Mm-hmm. We haven't quite caught up to Michael and Magnus, who we'll talk about in mm-hmm. a few minutes, but do you think that these people who were, let's at least in the States might call them bad boys, but people who mm-hmm. were living on the edge, really pushing the limits, mm-hmm. do you think that in your mind you thought this was a phase, meaning you would do this for a number of years and then at some point settle down, so to speak, and find somebody who's a little mm-hmm. more stable, who, you know, will pay the insurance bill when it comes in and not wreck the car and leave bottles laying around, so to speak?
I think, you know, when I was a teenager and until about my early to mid 20s, I had quite chronic depression. And I was also in, you know, like the punk scene, like there was a lot of aestheticizing of hedonistic behavior, you know. So it kind of tied into the subcultures I was part of in a way. It was quite normalized. And I also went for men who were as passionate as me when it came to music or when it came to film or when it came to literature and things like that. I would prioritize being with someone with the same interests as me over a healthy relationship, because yeah, that was really where I was at. I don't think I had much self-respect to be with someone in a healthy relationship, as sad as that is to say. At the time, I wasn't aware of that, though. I just thought it was quite normal in the subcultures I was in to be with unhinged dudes.
So it just felt like what you needed. You're just feeding what you need.
I can just give you one instance because it would probably paint a really good picture of who I was at 18. Because thank God I always remained really scholarly and I always had good grades and stayed in university or college, as you call it. But I think because I was such a high achiever, my outlet was kind of this secret life I led, getting involved in, you know, with all of these kind of dodgy death metal guys. So I did have a lovely boyfriend for like 2.5 years. He was this really nice guy. But yeah, things were just so calm. There was no fire. So it just got to a point where I was going to French class. And on the way home, there was this guy who lived between my university campus and my apartment I shared with my boyfriend. And I'd go there and spend time with him, you know, and he was out of control. He was drinking. He was you know, like self-harming. Yeah, it was pretty extreme. But for me, that's kind of, I don't know, that's what I needed, because I don't know if it's like a ADHD thing or a trauma thing, but I felt so dissatisfied and restless if I was just in a healthy, calm situation with a man that respected me. So that's, quite worrying.
So now when you mentioned self-harming,
mm-hmm.
what literally is going on?
Well, there's like this genre of metal. It's called suicidal black metal. And it's not a self-harming way. It's hard to explain unless you understand it, but it's like an aesthetic thing. So it's not a cry for help. It is a cry for help, obviously, but they don't see it as that. They see it as this kind of part of this subculture. It's an aesthetic thing to self-harm. Unless you understand this history of this black metal scene, it's hard to explain, but it wasn't that he was, threatening to kill himself or anything in front of me. It was just part of the subculture. But yeah, it's obviously quite an extreme behavior. I mean, this was in 2007, 2008. It was a while back. Doesn't make much sense to me now, but I think just as like a sheltered private schoolgirl, I found hanging out with all of these figures quite exhilarating, you know.
It would definitely make your heart pound pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this.
Uh-huh.
You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. or wherever fine podcasts are found.
So you move through that. You eventually graduate.
I did, yeah. Okay, what happened? So I graduated. Before I graduated, I was really lucky. I got to go to Europe with my Australian university. I studied art history. So I went to Venice, I lived in Copenhagen, I lived in Glasgow, so I did some Erasmus exchanges, and that was really nice because I kind of got away from all of that mess and ended all of the relationships I had going on and was able to just more so throw myself into my studies and travel and friendships. And it was a really empowering and inspiring period of my life for sure. And yeah, I was having a lot of fun. I was, you know, having healthy relationships, very lighthearted relationships. I was still part of this kind of death metal scene, so it was mostly with people also in that scene, but it was positive. There were a lot of women in it. It was quite dissimilar to what I'd experienced in Australia. But all of the nightmares started when I returned home after my Europe sojourn when I was 21.
When you came out of university and you're making your way around Europe and it has kind of an art bent to it,
mm-hmm.
what were you leading up to being? Were you trying to be some kind of a fine artist or something, or some art historian or teacher, or what is that?
I'm an art historian, yeah. So I'm still working on my PhD in art history. So luckily, through all of that, I was working towards this goal. I mean, I'm passionate about art history, but I also did it just to get visas and opportunities in Europe and be able to live here. So it was kind of a dual, several motivations behind it.
So you did the study abroad part and then came back to Australia. And that's when you ran into some of the trouble with guys that we'll talk about?
Yes. Yeah, this is where the real trouble started. Everything, all of the other things I listed were, as extreme as they sounded, quite peripheral. You know, it was quite normalized in the music subcultures I was in. So, the trouble started after.
How did you meet up with Michael, and what were your first impressions?
I was not interested in him. So not the kind of guy I would go for. And he was kind of this flamboyant artist. He was a painter, wore a lot of colors. And I was living with his ex-girlfriend of 7 years. So I was not really interested in anything with him. But for some reason, he decided to pursue me. And he would just show up, you know, at bars when I was there. And I was quite mean to him. I'd tell him to leave. I'd tell him I wasn't interested in seeing him. I'd be with all my friends and we just thought he was a weird, almost stalker kind of figure. And I kind of had the idea that he was pursuing me just to get back at his ex. They'd recently broken up. So I wanted nothing to do with him. But I suppose I was having a bit of a come down after these almost 2 years in Europe. And he showed up one night and he'd painstakingly illustrated like a 30-page notebook with these beautiful kind of visions of what he saw if we were to be together. It was almost like these apocalypse scenes, but beautiful ones. I don't know, maybe he was a little clairvoyant in that sense, but yeah, it was like a beautiful illustrated book. And I just thought, okay, this guy, if he's putting this much effort in, sure, why not? You know, I'm curious. If he really sees so much in me, he'd go to this effort. There's no one else doing that. So, sure.
When you think of his artistic style, because he could draw and paint, I'm sure. Probably did sculpture, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when he's painting, what kind of style would he paint in? Who can you direct us to and say has similarities to what?
The crux of the matter was I didn't really respect his art, you know, because I studied like an Italian Renaissance art history and French painting. And he would, like, I think, you know, it was around 2012 when street art was a really big thing, you know, when these, he did large scale murals, right? So he would get commissions to paint the wall of someone's business. And I thought, you know, street art was quite a low form of art. I didn't respect it. And I didn't really respect him as an artist. So that's kind of where it started out. And maybe he liked that in a way that perhaps other women would, you know, just sing his praises. I was very critical of him. Yeah. I didn't see it.
But then he does this book for you.
Mm-hmm.
And was that, in your mind, was that artistically sound? I mean, was it?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, yeah, I mean, you said beautiful. It was kind of beautiful. Right, yes.
It was. Like, he was a skilled illustrator, but I wouldn't say when it came to, you know, the large-scale works and the paintings he did, I was wowed by it or thought it was, his technique was impressive or there was any level of, like, concerted thinking behind it. It was just very decorative and he would just paint, you know, landscapes with dragons in them. It was quite, you know, almost deriving from fantasy and sci-fi. It wasn't really my cup of tea.
But on the other hand, the book did the trick.
It did, yeah. It made me curious. I mean, I was still, you know, I wasn't enamored by him or anything like that. There was still a lot of love bombing needed.
So besides the book, which is quite an effort to put that much time and risk the fact that you might turn your nose up at it, but you didn't. So in the early days of dating him, what was that like? Was it nice?
Yeah, I have to say I have a lot of memory loss. I don't know why, but I just have a terrible memory around this. And I think it's just because of what transpired after. But yeah, the start, it was nice. You know, I guess we went to the cinema, we went to bars, we had a nice time. I would come to a venue that he was painting a mural at. And from my memory, it was quite pleasant. And yeah, slowly I managed to fall in love with him. And yeah, I mean, I remember the first time where things started to go south and it was quite out of the blue and shocking. And from there, I would say it was like 6 months into dating. And from there, it was, quite nightmarish.
In most of these cases, there are warning signs or red flags that kind of lead. Love bombing for a lot of people. I mean, I talk with people about love bombing all the time, and I can totally understand how anybody could fall for that type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, somebody's taking you to nice places and spending money on you and buying you gifts and saying the right things and showing up and maybe looking a certain way or whatever that is. It's like, wow, this is getting better every time I see you.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I guess he had his version of that besides the book he gave you.
Yeah. And in some sick way, I thought, oh, I'm kind of breaking the cycle because I've never been with a guy like this who's, you know, not this dark kind of melancholic metalhead. You know, he was this flamboyant, colorful kind of happy painter who listened to rap music. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm breaking this cycle with him. Yeah, of course, as all of these situations start out at the start, it's wonderful. I really had my rose-colored glasses on at the start. It was just harmonious and easy until it wasn't. So I didn't see too many red flags, but I had heard from his ex that, you know, before she knew I was involved with him, that he was maybe a bit psychologically abusive to her, but I was young and I took it with a grain of salt, you know.
I think a lot of people look at it like, well, you know, maybe it was something about you and maybe you misinterpreted and you kind of write it off. And it's like, well, it seems very different to me, so I'm not going to listen to you. And I don't, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, when there's a breakup, you just assume if they're saying that only after the breakup that it's, well, this then I did that, you know, there's some tension there and I didn't take it so seriously as a 21, 22-year-old, unfortunately.
So when the bad behavior started coming, what kind of things do you remember happening?
It's really bizarre because his parents also lived in this beautiful house on the beach up north from the city we were living in. And it was my first visit. It was my first time meeting them. It's extremely strange. So I woke up in the middle of the night to this insane burning pain in my arm. And it was, you know, this real waking in fright. And I realized he was sinking his teeth into my upper arm, you know, while I was dead asleep. And I think the shock of that, and also just because it wasn't motivated by an argument or there wasn't anything leading up to it, I was so perplexed, but I was in so much pain. It was the middle of the night and I just started kind of screaming at him like, what the hell are you doing? And I think I kind of like pushed him and then he like slapped me and suddenly it was getting violent. It's quite a blur to me, but I remember there was kind of like some violence involved because I was just woken up from the dead of sleep by the worst pain. You know, I had this bruise on my arm for about a month. It was this huge purple black thing. So the first kind of act of violence was just so strangely out of the blue. It was so bizarre. It was just, so it really confused me because of course, the next day when his parents asked what was all the noise, he blamed it on me. He said I was mentally unstable and it was just so awkward. We were going to the airport to leave and, you know, I couldn't say anything, but they kind of had this impression that it was me who was unhinged. So that's how the dynamic started. It was bizarre.
Obviously, at some point, whether it was that night or the next day, you look at him and say, what were you doing? Right? I mean, you must have asked.
I must have. I don't have any memory of it. It's really frustrating, but just because it was such a traumatic situation, I think I lost a lot of those memories and I'd have to do more trauma therapy to get them back, unfortunately.
So you go to the airport and away you go, but you stay with them, obviously, because this relationship stays around for 3 years. So
3 years. Yeah. We moved to another Australian city and he was living in kind of like, he was living in his studio. He was renting a studio in a warehouse and he was living in there. I was also living in the city, but with housemates. Yeah. I do remember a lot of violence. I remember a lot of psychological abuse. I only have really snapshots of the worst times. there was one night where he had wanted to be in an open relationship. I didn't want to be, but he was kind of forcing it on me. He told me he had this kind of fetish for me to be with other people and tell him in detail about it. And I didn't really want to do it, but he was putting so much pressure on me to do it that I did start a relationship with a friend of mine. And in this relationship, I started to realize how unhealthy my relationship was with Michael. So Michael started to get jealous, especially when he was demanding all of these sexual details from me. And one night he showed up out of the blue at my house. I think he had smashed a window to get in. He grabbed a wine bottle and like smashed it and was threatening to stab me with it, threatening to burn my clothes. And then I think he had, you know, like a spray can, and he wrote in like huge black letters on my wall, "slut." And I was just so terrified, but unfortunately no one was home. So I threw his bag out the window and told him, you know, "you have to leave." And then the next day, I think that night I went to a friend's house, but I didn't know the friend so well. So I was really in a state of shock. I think I was just sitting in her bath shaking, really, really disturbed by what had gone on. You know, I got this sub-story text message from him saying, "you know, I slept in the street, you ruined my camera when you threw my bag out the window." And at that point, I think I had decided it was over with him. I was driving and with my friend the next day, and we passed him painting a mural on our way to a coffee store, and we just thought, "oh, you know, what trash. How could he treat me that way?" But I suppose I went back to him eventually. I think he bought me like a $500 necklace and vowed to never treat me that way again. So that's the main event I remember being particularly brutal. And after that, I moved to Poland with him.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that is a commitment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was supposed to be in Poland? Why would you go there? What's there?
He's half Polish. So his parents are Polish, even though he grew up in Australia. And we had a really good opportunity there. So we had an offer for a really large arts funding grant from a Polish private funder to help us establish an artist residency program for photographers in Poland. So I basically stayed with him because of that opportunity, which I shouldn't have, but for me it was exciting, and it was an amazing opportunity for my career to travel, to live somewhere new. So I took the bait. Yeah,
you sure did.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in Poland? We get more of the same bad behavior?
Yes.
We do.
Yes. It was hard because I went traveling in Europe by myself first before we moved to Poland. And just in having the distance from him, I was realizing what a rubbish human he was and how abusive he was. So I was in Berlin alone for, I would say, 5 or 6 weeks. And, you know, my mental health wasn't so great at that point either. So I started dating another guy casually, and we were meant to meet up in Vienna after that. And I had kind of decided I was going to leave him, but it was the cycle of abuse where you still love them and you're just so caught in it, you don't know whether to leave or to stay. And I had this opportunity in Poland. So I met up with him in Vienna. It was almost like I was being trafficked, because I got there and he somehow found out I'd been sleeping with someone in Berlin. So he took my laptop and my phone and dropped them out of like a 10-story window.
Oh my God.
So I had no way of escaping or leaving. And he really brutally beat me up in the room of a friend of his who we were staying with. And So I got my suitcase and I tried to leave because I just decided, screw this, I can't move to Poland with this guy. And I was on the streets of Vienna. I had no phone, no laptop. I think he'd also taken my wallet. So I just thought, well, what am I going to do? I don't have any way to escape this situation. So it was almost like a trafficking thing where he was like, you're coming to Poland with me. But it was really, it was really sociopathic in the way that it was like, you're coming to Poland, but you're going to be kind of like subservient to me and punished for what you've done. So that was how Poland started. And it didn't get much better.
How would you describe the 24 hours of your mind at that time? I can't imagine what that's like.
It was hell. It was hell. I went into psychosis. Especially, you know, at the point where I'd lost my all my access to the outside world, and I was kind of just with him in Vienna, I started to hear voices. It was extremely weird. And, you know, I was wearing this mask because the couple we were staying with, they had a baby, and I already felt so guilty that maybe they heard him, you know, like beating me up in the room we were staying in. And I started to hallucinate. I was helping the woman chop potatoes for dinner or something, and I heard in my head her asking me to throw the potatoes in the bin. And I was like, that's weird, but I heard it really clearly, so I did it. And then the next moment she was screaming at me, what are you doing? Why did you do that?
I take it that the bin is the garbage can. Is that what that is?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, the garbage can. It's an Australian term. Yeah, it was absolutely insane. I really thought I've lost it.
You would have to think that. You'd have to think that. Like you're hallucinating or, you know, you're not in touch with reality, but you're probably in such a deep state of anxiety. That's what's going on.
Yeah, it was just such intense kind of trauma response, anxiety, something that I literally started to lose my mind and hear voices. It was the most terrifying thing ever. Yeah, it was. Yeah, so Poland, that's how it started out. So you can imagine what's to come.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
This concludes part one of two parts with Alexandra. Be looking for part two on the When Dating Hurts podcast. Thank you for listening to the When Dating Hurts podcast. We have been steadily moving up in podcast review rankings based on downloads in the relationships category. That means more and more listeners are getting the kind of advice that can improve lives for victims, survivors, and their families. If you feel we need to hear your story, do not hesitate to email me at BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. That's BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. Hi, it's Bill Mitchell. I'm proud to say the When Dating Hurts podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To learn more about Evergreen Podcasts or to check out other shows on the Evergreen Network, just visit evergreenpodcasts.com.